Davis nerds and gigglovers, tonight on my episode, I have Nick from the NowX Project. Oh my word, right? I found this while scrolling, so you're going to love this one. Nick, how are you doing, love?
I'm good. How are things up in the north right now? Is everyone doing well?
Up in the north, we're doing very, very well, thank you. How are you down there?
Do you know what? I think everything's on fire. I don't know what's going on outside, but well, I'm just staying in my little creative cave, my little bubble, and shield the world out most of the time.
That sounds like a very artistic, creative thing to do. Yes, I'm just going to shield it out, make some music, do me projects, do whatever makes us feel happy, which I tend to do too, so I get that. Feels very much
on fire.
I
think a therapist might call that avoidance, but we can get into that later.
Not with me, it's not. It's called creative ingenuity.
Good. I like that. That's a good spin.
Honestly, it's so lovely to have you on, and I'm so grateful you said yes, because when I first found your project, it was like I said when I briefly spoke to you, I was sort of, this is not my usual thing. Everybody who knows what I do, I do try and go through a range of stuff. I have a really collective taste in music, but this just caught my ear and I had to go back and go, what was that? And I think it was on Instagram. It just popped up and I was like, oh, what was that? And it was just this really cool sound. And you've got this really cool image when you see it straight away. And I was like, oh, I like this. This is good, you know? So tell me a little bit about NowX. Tell me what has caught my ear. What are you about?
Do you know what? I'm trying to figure that out every day to some extent. I think I'm one of those people where there's like a million things that like there's so much stimulus that I like kind of take on all the time. And I think often with NowX, a lot of my challenge is almost like distilling everything that I'm interested in or care about or makes me feel anything into something that's like that people can understand or is accessible to even to myself, you know? I came from like a classical background musically, which is probably not surprising when people have like heard my music. It's funny, people always think it sounds more classical than I do, but I think because I came from that world, to me it sounds so far from that, but actually to most people who didn't come from that world it sounds close to that, you know. But it really, it's a pop project through and through. Like that's the main fundamental thing. I think it is very much like pop music at its core, and I've always loved and been excited by the idea of like what pop music could really be and like the sort of facets of it. But it's, I describe it when people ask, because people always ask, oh, what sort of music do you make? You know, if you get introduced to someone at a party or something, like, what sort of music do you make? And I always find that really, really hard to answer. But I generally would say it's semi-operatic emo pop. That's fundamentally what I think it is. It's got like a lot of different influences from classical to opera to big rock to like, you know, chart pop. But it is ultimately sort of semi-operatic emotional pop music. I think that kind of like sums up as best I can, you know.
No, it's true. It is. It does have this very pop feel about it. Initially, when I heard one of your tracks, I had to go back and listen at the beginning, and then your voice kicked in, and I was like, "Right, you're classically trained." So I hit that. I come from a classical background, and I was like, "Right, you're definitely, your voice is 100% classically trained." And then there's this huge kind of like pop thing comes in, and then there's a bit of kind of almost, I don't know, like there's this kind of 80s kind of ethereal kind of almost a bit Depeche Mode-y kind of thing comes in, and you're like, oh yeah, like this is good. And a lot of your tracks tend to build as you go through. They don't just start, they start off quite mellow and yeah, very chill, and then by the end of it they're absolutely, they fill out again, like some of the like the classical music stuff, how they build and build and build with the orchestral bit. So I heard that, maybe that's why I was like, oh, what is this? But you know, it's interesting as to how different it is, because there's a lot of singer-songwriters out there. There's a lot of, you know, general pop music goes on. There's a lot of this manufactured stuff. This doesn't feel like that. It feels like proper music, which I like. You know, I think that's important. What made you do it? If you're trying to explain to somebody at a party and then they go, so why are you doing this? Like, is this a dream of yours coming from a classical background?
Well, it's funny, just like, I'll get onto that, but it's funny that you picked up on like the build thing, because in a way, I guess that's like something that's quite classical as well. It's like the idea that a song sort of starts with this sort of motif or something really small and tangible as a melodic idea or something, and then becomes something massively epic as you sort of extrapolate what that idea really is. And I don't think I ever realized, like, I remember an ex-girlfriend once being like, you just see the world, like, I think as a negative criticism more than a compliment, but she was like, you know, like everything is just some grand narrative to you or whatever. Like, I think, and I think I can imagine how that's really annoying when you have to be around it. And I don't think I realized or felt or knew what she really meant until I like took a step back from my music. And I was like, oh, I think I get what she means. Like, I can't imagine, I always want a song. Like, I think the people I work with have to almost rein me in on that to some extent. Like, I always want a song to open out and become like this sort of world-changing, huge event. And sometimes like someone has to say, this one's not one of those songs. In terms of why I did it, I mean, it's more that I just can't not do it. I think it's one of those things. I think anyone who writes songs sort of understands like the sort of almost, and I say this cautiously, but like almost like the sickness of it. Like, I have always used this as my outlet since I fell in love with like weird emo bands when I was like 13, like bands my cousins in America, because my mum's American, like all my cousins were older and cooler and had this all this awesome music, and I'd go over there on holiday and I was like this, you know, the like slightly nerdy younger English kid who knew nothing, and they would just take me into their world and put records on in the car, and that's where all my music taste came from originally. And ever since that moment, like, I was just writing songs and buying guitars and trying to, like, you know, learn about it and getting really into, like, Leonard Cohen and all these things. And I realized from a really young age that I had, like, a sort of way of thinking about words, or the way I would write words wasn't really the way everybody else would. And that was always been with me. And since that moment, it's always been my outlet for, like, whatever's going on in my life that I have to deal with or I'm aware of, you know, like, psychologically, it's kind of just always been the only way I can really express myself clearly. I think if I tend to express things in just words talking or something, I tend to like dance around it for ages and say all these things, but it doesn't really mean anything. But when I actually put it on the page and sing it, I tend to get like straight to the heart of what I really feel. It's kind of an interesting thing I've only recently been like learning about now, like 15 years later after starting writing songs, you know.
Well, that's fascinating, and the fact that it is that and it becomes personal experience with music, and it's, you use it in a way that is really creative. It's not just a case of, oh well, I think I want to be famous, so I'm going to write a tune today, or I want to be a singer. It's more of a project. It's with heart. It comes out from the soul rather than something that is just made for media's sake, which I think comes through a little bit, you know. I mean, I've really hammered your stuff this last couple of weeks, and it's been a really interesting experience to hear what comes through. And you know, some of it is really emotional. I'll come to something in a minute that caught me off guard. And I think that does shine. And I think that is another attraction point for what you do. I think I can't stand pre-generic stuff. I think, okay, sometimes you get a hit pippy poppy song and it's great, but like the musicality is there, and the quality of lyrics, should I say. A bit Mark Bolan used to write a lot of poetry and stuff, because obviously he liked to express himself in different ways. Other bands like to do the same. This has the same feel as you've just said. Sorry, I'm waffling now. Tell us to shut up.
No, it's sort of one of those things you can sort of talk about forever, isn't it? It's like, I think because I grew up on the sort of music I did, which was really dense lyrically. Like, yes. I mean, my favorite band as a teenager was probably like Bright Eyes, which is also very like The Cure, kind of Leonard Cohen inspired. Yes. And like, it was always so dense lyrically, and I just found so much joy in that. And I found that such a surprise from everything I'd ever grown up listening to or was aware of. Like, suddenly people were saying all these things in songs, and I didn't even know you could do that.
Yeah.
And that was a massive revelation for me, and it really genuinely changed my life at that point, like realizing that songs could be as powerful as that and could say what they did. I think what was the real journey for me starting from that place was my vocal, the way I sing, doesn't actually always suit having incredibly dense lyrics, because I think the denser lyricists tend to be the singers with more rhythmic kind of spoken voices, like Bob Dylan and yeah. Leonard Cohen. Like, they all have this kind of gruff thing and they can say like 1,000 words really quickly and it sounds really cool, you know. But like,
yeah,
when you sing like I do, you actually, the tone of your voice is doing a lot more work in a way. Or the space in your voice is doing a lot more work than just the lyrics. And that's different to some of those artists. And I think I realized like Jeff Buckley and people was a better reference point for me, because they would do these longer phrases. Yeah. So that, you know, that's like a whole other journey, but
this whole thing, I mean, like, again, sort of The Cure as well, they do have a lot of expression, but it's not necessarily huge, big, big sentences, excuse my Geordie accent coming out there, huge sentences and things. It's got that whole, there is that whole sort of like, sometimes they are a bit short and snappy, and it works. No, it's really good. It's really good stuff. And I actually put your, we obviously have a chat for the people that I do the Nerdy Up North with, and I put your stuff in. I was like, guys, like, I think I have to get this on. Like, I have to. What do you think? And a few of them were like, oh my God, this is something different. Do you know what I mean? We really like this. And it seems to have peaked with, obviously, I like The Cure, I like The Sisters of Mercy, I like Depeche Mode, I like, you know, and again, what you're saying with The Sisters of Mercy, they love putting, you know, Andrew L. just loves putting great big long sentences and, you know, poetic influences, you know, Marx and Engels, stuff all that in it. It works so well, you know. I am curious to get to why you did it, though, because I think there's a bigger reason behind this, apart from just expression.
Why I started this project?
Yeah. You don't have to say if you don't want to.
No. It's not. I'll always be as honest as I can if I know what it is I feel. I mean, I think it. I always knew I was going to do this with my life. And I think, and I played in bands growing up and at uni and all this sort of stuff. And it was all kind of gearing up to all as like the right project. And then I sort of fell into the film world and like sort of lost sight of it a little bit. And then this was when I restarted back and was like, you know, it's time, I have to do this now. This was what the project that kind of obviously like emerged from that. I mean, I'm trying to think what it is that you're getting at specifically. Why don't you tell me, give me a clue.
So what I was interested in when I was reading about you, as I do, because I'm nosy, I was fascinated that it sort of had a reference that you use this project to sort of, for some of your music, for your directing work, because you are a director as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is super cool, because this comes onto the whole thing of, you know, is it just a music project, or does it cross art boundaries for you? Is that important? That's what I'm trying to...
But it was so funny. I thought there was like something really specific that I might have said at one point that you've honed in on, but no, you are right. I mean... Well,
how nosy do you think
it was more the other way around, in a way. I almost actually used my film directing to create like a cinematic pop project more than I used created a band in order to be able to like use music for films. I mean, my whole like grand ambition, I guess, with this whole thing in the long run would be to like be able to combine them in like a bigger way or more interesting way. But that's sort of something I'm just slowly chipping away at. I've done a couple smaller things where I've gotten to do music for my own things, but it's sort of just like, it's a lot. I think with NowX, like, I already ask so much of my fan base and like audience, because it is, you've picked up on that, it is this very multi-dimensional, cross-genre, you know, like big project in a way, with a lot of, which takes in a lot of kind of influences in different ways. And it does, I think I've had to work really hard to almost train my audience to expect anything. And that is a certain way of having to build a project. Like, I know like a lot of bands that sort of have their sound and they have their way of writing and they sort of repeat that. And that can be great and people love it forever. And it, you know, and it obviously evolves over time. Like my thing, I always wanted to feel boundless with like the way I expressed ideas or musical ideas, and I think that's been fine, you know what I mean? Sometimes I'm like, am I actually doing too much? But actually, like, I think that the most important thing you have to do is like be authentic, you know, to what it is you're making. And to me, like, I have to produce the song the way I hear it in my head and the way I can imagine it. And if I don't, then I'm actually curating it into something that's more artificial. And like, if it's so be it that like there's a lot of different textures coming through in the different songs, like I think that my audience actually appreciate that, and it means my show has a lot of different colors and like everything sounds different, you know. It's kind of one of my least favorite things when like you go to a show and everything almost sounds the same over, like it's different songs, I guess, technically, but they sound identical. And that's kind of one of the things I've always disliked, so I've just wanted to really go like put it out there, you know.
I love it, that's great. And you sort of said color there, and color is a really big word in your project. Like, everything is colourful, like, not just the visuals, but the sound. I mean, there's a lot of really visual, cool stuff going on. And even your logo is, like, pink, and there's a lot of, like, lights and a lot of different colours in there, which I am completely devoid of most of the time in my life. So it's interesting that when you watch your videos, how there's all these kind of, like, really cool little bits and lights and stuff like that. Is there, when you are sort of... thinking about your videos and you're planning stuff, and you're obviously from a directorial background, is there anything that influences you directly that you think I have to have this sort of feel to the project, or anything that would influence the feel? So some of the bands I've worked with have very sort of like Blade Runner feels and stuff like that. Anything that would sort of, you know, tip you in that sort of way?
Well, I think visually I'm sort of like I am, you know, like I was just talking about with like the production of the songs. Like I think that I heard Matty Healy talking about this, and it kind of like spoke to me, where he talks about like kind of the making things for the avoidance of boredom in creativity. And I think that I am very much one of those personalities that like once I've done a thing, I really just like don't feel like I ever need to do it again. You know what I mean? I'm like,
yeah,
oh, cool,
yeah.
I did that thing. I had that experience. I kind of want to have like a million different creative experiences within this one project. And so each time I do a new song or a video, whatever, like I try to deliberately push myself to go to something somewhere that I haven't been. And it's usually just based on what am I interested in at the time, you know, like what weird book or what weird old film or what director or what, you know, what news thing or anything. Like I kind of just, I'm constantly creating stuff because it's just the nature of this kind of like the world that we live in now, this kind of single culture and the constant kind of like conveyor belt of media. And so you kind of have to just grab what's around you at any given point and just channel that into what you're doing in a way that, you know, people might like find interesting or that you're going to find interesting. And so, yeah, I guess I do that. But fundamentally, I think color, in terms of color, I do these color coded eras, which is not like, I'm definitely not the first person to do that, but I really like it because it really focuses like a period of time. Like, I think there's something really beneficial to like limitations when you're creating, because sometimes when you have too many options, it can kind of make everything a bit meaningless or destroy what you're doing. I think actually for me, like if I know that we're doing this like Pink EP cycle or something, like the show then kind of revolves around that, the merch can revolve around that, and then we sort of have a world to like play within. And I like to have that because I don't generally have a lot of limitations on what I'm doing, you know, like I don't even have a manager, I don't have a record label, I don't have any of the sort of structures that a lot of artists have. So I generally can, and there's no, you know, I'm the only person in my band apart from, you know, I play with session players and stuff. So in a way, you know, I never really have any limitations unless I put them on myself.
Which is good. And I think that's important. Do you feel that you probably wouldn't fit into having a record label? Do you think to have that freedom is you?
Yeah, it's such an interesting time. And I've been having this conversation even today, driving one of my drummers around, like, so we did a little music video last night and just returning drums to studios. Like we were just having this chat for ages in the car. Like everyone that I know who's on these, so especially major label deals, is trying to get out of them or in the process of being dropped. And these are some very successful artists as well, like what anyone would consider successful artists. And I don't, you know, I'm very careful not to like, I have nothing against big labels. I have nothing against any of those sort of entities at all. But in terms of whether I love having like the freedom to do this. I do this for like the joy of creating in a way that I want to and performing. And like, you know, I've got a lot of friends who are stuck on effectively like the shelves of major labels and they're suffocated because they don't get given any money to do anything. It's not their choice. They've got all these creative limitations. They don't own everything that they've made anymore. And it slightly feels like the modern sort of equivalent of, you know, sort of Paganini or like selling your soul to the devil in return for something, but actually accept that you're not really getting all that much in return anymore necessarily, you know, and you are stuck in this sort of binding agreement. And I'm sure there are great like stories of really successful relationships with labels and artists and, you know, I know of some and friends bands who, and it's great, but I would love to work. I love collaborating and I love working with people, but I think with what I do and the way I want to do it, I think it just has to, so like even more so than normal, be like specifically the right people at the right time in the right way. And I definitely am always looking for that, but I, you know, I'm also quite like content forging my path, you know, and carrying on and do it and making sure that I still love it, you know, because it's easy to, music is an easy world to accidentally fall out of love. You know what I mean?
Yes. No, it is. This is a conversation I had with, it was the frontman of the Futureheads, Barry Hyde. He said to me, it was something he just lost, just lost his love for it for a little bit, and then got out of it and was like, kind of want back in.
I watched that chat that you had with him. It was really cool.
No way.
Yeah, well, just earlier. I thought that was really, really interesting that someone in his position like has similar feelings about that whole world. I think it's more just fear, you know, like, as I say, I have nothing against those like big labels or any labels or anything. I think maybe just as a small, effectively a small fish, you just have that like fear of the unknown of what other bigger entities coming in would do. So, you know, but I'm always open to experiences, and I think
if it happens and if it works and if it's going to be right for you, then yeah, it works. And for some people I know who have been on labels and have gone, I never want to go back there again, or I want to, maybe I would if it was right, or I like the autonomy of my own work, I like to know what I'm publishing, I like to know I've still got the rights, I haven't got to then go down a legal contract route. Or, you know, I think it's finding in the music industry at the moment, particularly now, is finding how it works for everybody. How it's going to work specifically for you. Is a record label going to be the right thing, or is going daring that going out on your own and doing it yourself? And partly one of the reasons I set up this podcast was to find bands that had either done it independently or doing it independently, or are trying to, you know, forge their way into it. You said about collaborations, right? I was listening to all your stuff and I found this really cool kind of, like, the only way I can describe it, it's like a cinema. It was like a cinemascape, kind of like very arty kind of thing with the Gold Crush.
Mm-hmm.
I need to ask about that, because I heard it and I was like, That's good.
So Gold Crush is one of the main collaborators that I have across quite a bit of my work. He's a guy called Paul Visser. He's actually the front man. You might know the band that he sings in because you're in the sort of heavy world, but he's the singer of a band called Black Orchid Empire, who've definitely been around. Like, you should check them out, and you should have him on at some point, because he's such an amazing musician and thinker about music as well. I mean, he's done half the music for MasterChef, but then he's a front man of a metal band, and then he writes like pop smashes with me. You know what I mean? He's just a man of like a jack of all trades. But we did that soundtrack together for a film that I made for Vice before Vice kind of went under last year. And it was a film about a really close friend of mine. So it was a really interesting documentary project that they put together and got me to direct, about someone that I know who's a sort of famous writer, Instagram kind of personality. And so we actually made this, that was the soundtrack that we'd made for that film. So you can go and watch the film and hear all that music, but that's what that little, and then we just put a few of them on Spotify, but the whole soundtrack with 30 minutes of it is on YouTube as well, if you want to like hear the rest of it.
I will be having a listen to that. It was, again, I had my earphones in and I was doing, as I do, 10 things at once. And I was just like, that is like, it's cool. And again, the CinemaScope kind of thing came through, that it will be something more for like, you know, directing. It was really, really cool. It was just very different. Something I've not heard before. And it's quite interesting to say that this other gentleman is in metal, and then obviously this seems to be a recurring theme of everybody I kind of go, I like this, all seem to have this ability to cross genre, right? Yeah. It was the same with Ellen from Ellen. She obviously is metal band, she's in like a metalcore band, and then she writes like stuff on her own and solo stuff and singer-songwriter, and you're like, how do you manage to have all this talent and just do all these wonderful things? It's amazing.
Well, you know, it's funny. Paul and I, like Gold Crush and I, have been started recently writing a lot of songs for other people, which has been like a whole new thing in my life. And it's such a cool creative challenge. But like, you know, because what I do for NowX is so specifically what I do for NowX. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think of it in a certain way. It comes and it's born in a certain way. I live it in a certain way. And it's authentically like what I want to put out as my voice, you know? But it's really cool to suddenly be able to write something for, I don't know, for like a K-pop or something. You know what I mean? Like to be able to just think about songwriting in a whole different way, to have to be like, this song is not for me. This song is for possibly a K-pop female artist. But like, what's the idea? And like, how would you write that song if it's not for me? Which is a whole different way of writing.
Yeah.
And I've really enjoyed diving into that, to be honest. Like, and I think maybe actually I've got more of a kind of like, I don't know, more of like more ability to write for others than I ever thought or gave myself credit for, I guess. So that's been like a really fun thing to just take my head out of NowX for a bit, you know.
Move on to something different. And it's got to be hard, because when you're writing for yourself, you know how your vocal range works and you know what you like and what you want. But if you don't, and you don't know what necessarily, you may be right, okay, this person can sing like this, but how you get their emotions, that's amazing. And that's really, really cool. And I know you directed, obviously you said you've directed a few things, but I know you directed a couple of documentaries. Is it weird having to come out of the music sort of head and then go right directing head for something completely different that maybe doesn't have any music attached to it, or you're interviewing? Because obviously interviewing is one of my things. It's something I've done from being quite young. But to chop and change between things, do you find that different? Or
yeah, it's like a constant like battle in my life, I guess. I mean, I spend most of my time doing NowX. Like that is, you know, fundamentally, that takes up most of my time. But I've got, yeah, I've directed 2 feature documentaries, like kind of, but that was really before I was doing this project. Now I'm doing, like, I'm sort of picking and choosing various projects that I'm sort of developing over time that are just things I'd love or want to make. I'm not like directing all of them. I'm producing a couple, like a film about the opera world, this really dark thriller about Don Giovanni that I've been working on for a few years that I'm really excited by, but I'm not going to direct that. Like that's, so I've always loved to do lots of things, and like really, I just love the adventure of like creating lots of different things, I guess. And when I started NowX, like I didn't want to stop having to do that. And a lot of people early on, like that I would meet with, or record label people or industry people, like a lot of them would sort of, I knew that they weren't the right people to work with when they would ask me which one I was going to pick. And I was like, I don't see anyone asking, you know, like Childish Gambino to pick between, you know, rapping and comedy and Atlanta, his film series. Yeah. You know what I mean? We live in the age of like multidisciplinary creation. Like we live in the age where the more things you do, actually the better in a way. And so I kind of always knew that that wasn't the right approach. So I tried to balance them all and do things. I mean, it is hard. Like it's hard to switch gears. It's weird to switch from behind the camera to in front of the camera all the time. That was something I had to get used to. But you know, at the end of the day, like it's that avoidance of boredom, you know, like I'm never creatively bored. And I think that is because of, if I get like tired or upset with certain thing like NowX or something's not going well, I can just like think, okay, well, maybe I'll like go make a short film or something, or you know, put my head in something else. And I've really enjoyed that. Yeah,
that's great. And that shows, it does show. I mean, obviously you had your new single, I've seen a few of your videos, and each time something's a bit different, and it's either a different image or a different color scope, or like you said, or something a bit different. But your new single track was out, Artificial Flowers, the new videos just dropped for that, and it's a really, it caught me really off guard emotionally, this video to start. Yeah. Like the opening, I was just like, oh, was not expecting that. Was that something, obviously there's a couple of things in this that really I really liked as well, but you obviously had the dog in it, and I've got a name written down, Bianca.
Oh yeah.
Bianca. Was this something you worked with? Because I know it was a different director. It was Ghost House Media.
Yeah. So Gabby Stella, who is Ghost House Media. He's one of my like main kind of film world collaborators. Like we go off traveling and doing films for people quite a lot when I'm not touring, and he often comes on tour and drives the tour bus and then shoots content, and you know, so he's like a real kind of mate and like and collaborator. And he did the Cold Beds of Strangers video as well, and the one for Body High, which is going back when we rented out a theme park during COVID because you could do that. So he's great, and like yeah, he lives in Glasgow, so the idea kind of just more stemmed around like I needed a video really quickly. This has kind of become the new thing like I was talking about, like, you know, when you're constantly having to put stuff out and it's single after single after single, and you always have to have a visual to go with a song release, because otherwise how are you gonna promote the song? And it's funny that it's more about how are you gonna like promote the song like with clips from a video rather than the video itself. Like our videos themselves get far fewer views than like they do on social media, and you know, if we need to run advertising for shows or whatever, that's where these visuals actually really come into their own and like play a role in a way. But I needed something really fast, and he and his wife live up in Glasgow, and I was just like, what can we do? Like I've always wanted to go to the Highlands to do a music video, like let's just do it, like how's like next week, you know what I mean? And it was basically that, and we just came up with the idea, and I'd wanted to do something that was reflecting on like kind of loss and grief and that sort of thing for a while, but the dog only really came into it really late on, like, you know, basically when he picked me up at the airport the day before we were going to shoot, and he had the dog in the car, and I was like, wait, because I've been thinking like I don't want to do this, it's gonna be a video with just me, but like, you know, this, and that's fine, you can do that, but I almost needed a co-star, and then there she was, like just sat there in the front seat, and I was like, I think this is now all coming together, you know?
Totally adorable. And I saw this little like blooper when obviously when this goes out wrong, you need to check the video out. It really threw me off guard and it's a really great song. But there's a little blooper on the Instagram on the now. It's called, the Instagram is your.now.x, which I was like, that's quite interesting. But there's a little blooper on there of you in the tent. I think it was either on a story on there where you were shouting to Bianca and she's jumping around inside the tent. And it was really adorable. It was super cute.
Well, they always say in film, like, you should never work with animals or children because they're so difficult to work with often. I mean, not all the time, obviously, but I think, you know, it looks very seamless, all those scenes with the dog in the Artificial Flavors video. But actually, like, it was a lot of, you know, there was like 15 repeated takes of like the same little look, you know what I mean? And then you just take the one that actually worked. So that little blooper was effectively just what I was having to do in the tent to get her to sort of interact with me, you know? Otherwise she just sat there or just did her own thing, you know?
She was very cute. I must admit, I'm a bit of a dog person. So I was like, oh, it's so adorable. It's so adorable.
If you like,
I
mean, this, you'll find this cute actually. Hold on. If you're into dogs. So this is, there's been this like kind of joke a bit within my fan base for a while, because I've always like Chow Chows are like my favorite dog, or like the one I would have if I could have a dog and wasn't touring all the time. And that became a bit of a joke, because I would like refer to it as like, I'm going to have a Chow Chow and it's going to be called Chow X. And so somebody painted this Chow X. It's got the logo, but with Chow X. And gave it to me. And I was just like, that is like the cutest, sweetest, most thoughtful gift ever. So it sits on my piano right here all the time. But yeah, someday Chow X will be real, but for now it's a figure of our imaginations.
Because until you can either take a dog on tour with you, I think you're going to be touring all the time. And it's because I think this is one of those things that somebody, every comment I looked on every video was like, this has to be bigger. This is amazing. These are going to be bigger. And you could see it just on every, normally YouTube is just filled full of negativity. You see it all the time. Facebook, YouTube, negativity all the time. Somebody's always got something nice to say. Not on your videos, there's just comment after comment after comment of people going, this is incredible. This is great. This is huge. So I think that's really cool. But honestly, I love the challenges.
Yeah. Well, you hope, someday we'll have, you know, a dressing room just for Chowex, and that'll be the
when you get to the point, you can take one onto a dog onto it. Absolutely. I mean, the video is beautiful. It is beautiful. It is very emotional. I mean, I'm not a great emotional person. I tend to hide any emotions. I was a bit like, oh, a bit choked up there.
Oh, well, not good. I don't know.
But I saw one where you had, I mean, it's funny you mentioned the clips. Now, I've got a question to ask you about social media later on, but you mentioned the clips, and one of them is of you. It looks like it's a live show, but this ball pit. So what happened there? What possessed a ball pit? I mean, I'm gathering the colour, but I just so cool. It's so.
Do you know what? Again, here's the thing. If I'm truly honest, like, and I think this is like important in these discussions we're having about, you know, the industry and how it all works and stay, you know, like I've somewhat had to sacrifice some of the production, like, scopes of my videos now that we're touring, because again, like, I don't have a label paying for everything. So like, for me to take the show on the road, like, I am the one who, like, alone, who has to take that whole financial risk and put it together. And like, you know, it's especially true because I'm not a band. Like, I'm a solo artist that has a band, and they're all professionals, and like, that's the reason our show can be the way it is, because the talent that I'm able to draw from, you know, and with those people is so high. And like, I can choose a band that suits what it is I'm trying to do at any given point, but that comes with a cost. And just being on the road in general, like, I was reading like some pretty shocking, you know, articles about how the cost of touring has like escalated with Brexit and all these different things. So, you know, and just generally the cost of living and all these things, it really escalates the cost of touring. So I used to really push the boat out and do these quite extravagant videos when I was starting out, because there wasn't any shows to play. And so any money that I had put aside or could spend on the project, I was, and it was basically going into videos, because it wasn't so expensive to record the songs. It was really more just like promoting them. But now, you know, we've got like, you know, we're about to announce probably 20 more dates, I think, for the spring in Europe. And that's a lot going on. So in a way, I've had to kind of decide and prioritize. And so I think the cool thing for me is, like, because of my film background, and because of all the contacts in that world and favors I can pull and whatever, like, it does mean I can do things for not like, for less money, that are going to be like still interesting and fun and different. But I definitely have had to say, like, there's been this sort of shift recently into like, which I've actually really enjoyed, honestly, because sometimes, again, it's that limitation thing. When you know you can only spend a small amount of money on a video, like, how are you going to make it compete with your more expensive or more, like, ambitious ones? And so I've actually really enjoyed being able to do less in a way, because it pushes you more, like, it's more of a challenge. So the ball pit was like, you know, I can get these bags of balls, plastic balls. Like, we knew we had a studio we were going to record in, but we were just a bit like, well, how's that's going to look a bit flat, you know? Like, what are we going to do to make this a bit more interesting? Everyone's seen a million studio videos. And so suddenly it was just more this thought, like, it's not a very big room. Like, how many balls would it take? I don't know where this idea came from, but sort of how my brain works a bit. But like, it's like, how many balls would you have to put in that room to make it, to fill it up? And I think we all thought a few hundred balls and it was going to be awesome. And then we went online and, like, naturally, because the internet is like a weird and wonderful place, someone had created a calculator where you could work out how many ball pit balls you needed to fill any sort of cubic space, basically. And so we just, like, looked on that, and we thought, like, 500 balls was going to be, like, great, and that was only, you know, 50 quid or something. We looked on there, and it reckoned for the size studio we were going to be in, we needed 20,000.
Oh my God.
Just get up to, like, knee or kind of hip level, even. I think, like, knee level. So we ended up getting in, like, 6,000 balls, which you can't really tell in the video because it just looks like a bunch of balls and people, but it's a lot of balls in that video. And actually the guy, that's Gold Crush's studio, funnily enough, his old studio. And he was finding balls, like, in his touring gear for, like, months later. He'd just find another ball. Like, so, but, you know, I really liked that. And it's just part of that whole effort to make things, like, you know, in a sustainable way that are still fun and exciting. And the Highlands was like that with artificial flavors too. It's like, it wasn't an expensive film to make, but we pushed the concept, like, to a really interesting place because of that, and actually, you know, it's one of my favorite videos. So actually, I think sometimes it's better to do less but do it in the right way,
make it work. Yeah. And it, like you say, you're funding this yourself, and this is something that comes up quite a lot in my podcast. You've got to do it in a way that's economical for you. You don't want to be bankrupting yourself over this, because you know, like you say, a lot of things now are just a 10-second reel. I'm gonna push a question forward. Do you think that social media has changed how the music industry works with this? Because you're saying about these reels and, like, how we use big videos. You put all this money into a big video, somebody's going to view a 10-second reel. Mm-hmm. And, like, a few of the things I've only seen a few bits of. I mean, I've watched most of the videos now all the way through a couple of times. I've listened to everything and gone. And I'm starting to see it all come together in the art form. But do you think it's important, or do you think it's damning to the industry, or do you think it's just completely changed how it works?
You know, I try really hard to not be one of those people who sits around cynical about the way things are, you know? Like, yeah. I can see all the ways that it used to be possibly better. You know what I mean? Like, I think the sort of commoditization of music in the modern way, I guess through the sort of devaluation of, like, the physical idea of music into something that's sort of effectively free, you know, I can see how that's, like, created the sort of dilemma of, like, being a modern pop musician in a way. Like, you can't rely on things, like, nothing really, you can't really rely on things you used to be able to rely on to, like, build a business. But at the same time, I guess the flip side of that is there's more opportunity than ever to be heard. But I think the problem, I guess, is that, like, it creates this sort of inevitable saturation where, like, every person, like, who thinks they want to be a pop star is out there, like, making content about music. And I guess the problem is then, like, the content that's the most catchy is what actually rises to the top, not the music that's the best. So you've got, like, these really incredibly gifted content creators, which they are, like, I'll give them that for sure, you know, possibly creating quite mid music a lot of the time, but rising to the top and possibly blocking out a lot of really interesting projects that maybe where people aren't, you know, most artists actually aren't the personalities to be incredible internet influencers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing, like, I feel somewhere in the middle of it all because, you know, I like performing. I know how to make films. I think I'm one of those sort of introverted extroverts, you know what I mean? Like, I can, and in a way it should massively play into my strengths, but I grew up on artists, loving artists where there was so much mystery.
Yes.
And that's really important and powerful too. And honestly get so lost in that whole conversation. Like, and if you've got any thoughts on the best balance of this, because I don't know whether it's better to really, like, you know, put yourself out there online to sell you, you know, the ups and downs of that versus, you know, like actually using like what you make to speak, letting that speak for you, which is kind of how people used to do it. I think there's such pros and cons to both. And I never really know where I sit on it. I don't know what you think.
It's tough, I think. I mean, I've obviously seen there's one band that I really love who they're masked. And they tour all the time because they're old school. They like to tour. They don't have this massive social media. They don't have TikTok. They've got a Facebook. They've got an Instagram. But it's more touring. They're more on the road all the time. They're about the writing. They're in the studio. Mm. And they direct a lot of their own stuff. Like, you know, Mercury, he directs a lot of his own stuff. You know, he's very that way. Whereas there's a lot of bands, Speed Air, who I had on very first, they do the opposite. They tour all the time. But they also have a lot of big social media presence, like really out there. And I personally, with this, obviously I'm still learning this. This was a project that I just took on. I decided, I mean, I used to do this back in the day, but I sort of decided, right, I'm going to do it again. But this time I've had to use my face, and that's not natural to me. I am an extrovert introvert, but it's not natural for me to have my face out there. It's not something that I normally do. And I get my head around that and doing the little videos going, well, tonight on the Nerdy Up North YouTube channel, you will have this, and put myself out there. Scary, I think. And I think getting that right and not just coming across like a sort of somebody who's just putting their face out there for the sake of it and missing out on any sort of skill that I've got. I think it's quite difficult to get that balance, you know, especially being a female. It's going to sound really, really daft, but being a female, there is that expectation for you to have this image as well, which I try not to fall into that gap.
Mm-hmm.
I know I try to keep it very much like, you know, I am who I am and my personality.
And I think you've got a great image, just say it, to be fair.
thank you very much. And likewise, although I did notice you changed your hair on a few of the different videos as well.
Well, you know, the avoidance of boredom.
Mine's just been the same forever. It's just the same bleach, bleach blonde forever. But it's that whole kind of thing of putting yourself out there. And having the bravery to do it, I think, doesn't, like you said, doesn't always come naturally to really, you know, really introvert or arty people. I'm trying to find a balance. Whereas I think you've got it, if you ask me your opinion, I think you've got it right. I mean, I found you on social media. That is how I found you. You know, it was a little video that popped up, and I think it was for, I'll come to this, but it was for Head of Steam. And I was looking, sitting, going through on a night time, and I was just scrolling through looking for, you know, stuff that I'm interested in, sounds and gigs and, you know, anything like that, because that is one of my passions. I mean, I don't play in a band. I don't write music myself. You know, I like observing it. I'm an observer. I like to watch people, like the people watch. I love being at a gig and watching what everybody else is doing, as well as what's on stage and listening to it.
So there's guitars in the background. Those are just props.
No, I do play. I do play, but yeah, they are just props for now. Dusty ones.
They literally don't make sound. They're just decorations.
They're just decorations. They're just pieces of wood, Nick.
Yeah.
But I think you've got it right. You know, that whole thing of it popping up there for me was just perfect. Mm. It was targeted right. And you have that presence in it, but your art is not overshadowed. You know, the content is good. The music is good. It's there. The Instagram isn't in your face, you know, but at the same time, I'm still getting content coming up. And today I've seen like posts, and I saw posts the other week, and, you know, it's really feels quite, you've got it. If I was looking to how to do it, I would probably look at what you're doing, if I'm honest with you.
It's really great to hear that, because I think inevitably, and this is again what I was saying about not sitting around and thinking things are bad, you know, like, I think in music, there is inevitably, like, always people very close by who are getting insane numbers, you know what I mean, like streams. Yeah. And we live in a very number centric kind of world, but actually I made this very conscious decision a couple of years ago to not do anything for the project, especially not spend money for the project on anything that was like purely vanity related. Like, I know a lot of people in music spend a lot of money on vanity related things, like, you know, people, I mean, everything from juicing streaming numbers to whatever, I mean, all sorts of different sort of online promotions and this, that, the other. And to me, the most important thing was ticket sales. And it kind of has been since we started touring. I was just thinking about it. I was like, what's the opportunity like in this industry right now? And just looking around. And actually, I think it just became really clear really quickly that like, there was a lot of noise online. there's a lot of people fighting for that, like real estate, digital real estate. But how many of these bands could go to, like, you know, Munich or like Berlin and sell a couple hundred tickets, and, you know, like really play a show and build in all these different places? And I was like, that feels to me the bit, if you can figure out how to do it at a small scale independently, there's a real opportunity there, because like you've got all these different local communities that you can become a part of and like target and go to and like and build a whole thing that could actually sustain itself as a business. Because I want to be doing this in 20 years, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or 15 years, whatever it is. Like I really, and that's when we talk about labels, like I'm not looking for like a short-term buzz from something that's unsustainable to repeat, whatever. Like I see social media as like a luxury bonus on top of the band and project and like career that I want to build. And if that also takes off, then that's amazing. But I don't see it as a strategy, because I just think you don't own it really. And it's not necessarily like in your control. And I've always tried to focus on things that would be, which to me is actually more so like touring and ticket sales. You know, it makes sense. It's like ones and zeros, and you can kind of build that shape however you want to build it. And you know, I've definitely had to learn through that process, and we're just at the beginning. We've done like a few tours, you know, now, and the biggest one's sort of coming up in a month or so. So in a way, it's kind of I'll have to talk after that and I'll tell you what I learned about it. But you know, that to me is always like an indisputable metric in a world of numbers, is how many people actually would like pay to come and see you do your thing. And you, yes, can only really get that from, like, I think, the emotional connection between the music, you and the audience, and that sort of triangle. And that is the bit that I put all of my attention into, because it's the one bit I think that really, really matters, is that like triangle, you know?
I agree. I totally wholeheartedly agree. I think it is the ticket sales. I think it's the show. It's who will turn up to see you, because anybody can sit and stream. And it sounds daft, and that does make money, but not the money you would think. It's the merchandise, it's the tours, it's the tickets. This is why I've always said, and everyone, you know, buy a ticket. If you sound so, hear something you like and they're saying a show, buy a ticket.
Right.
That ticket puts it on, so that means the gig can go ahead.
It's the best thing that anyone can really do, I think, if you want to support music, is like go see your favorite projects every time they come to town. You know, like that's the easiest way. If you can afford it, it's the easiest way to help and like keep that alive, I think, you know. And it's the joy, it's the reason you do it, right? Like,
yeah,
for me at least, like I just, like, when I'm at home, I'm just like sitting around, you know, I'm waiting to be on tour again. Like there's nothing like, you know, you write this song in your bedroom, whatever, and you put it out there. Like there's nothing like seeing that come back at you, you know, in towns where they don't even speak English. You know, yes, what I mean? That is the joy of this, and the bit I really cherish and hold on to. The rest is all kind of, it's all noise a bit to me, you know, like I just try and make sure that I can keep doing that and having that connectivity with everyone in a, like a really as profound and important and like, you know, a way as possible.
Connection. Yeah. I think it's a huge thing. You know, I don't look at stats. I don't look at numbers, figures. I try not to look at the views on my videos. I try not to have, it's not about that. It was never about that. It's about the music and the passion and the gigs and the whole, the performers. Cause I try and get obviously performers on as well. Cause I think it's important to acknowledge it. Not everything is a musical. You can have all sorts of different things happening, you know, all sorts of different shows. I mean, you've got your tour coming up, you mentioned it. The 4th of October is the Head of Steam in Newcastle. I'll put this out well before then. I will be there. I want to see it really ramped. The Head of Steam's a great venue. Have you been?
No, so I guess like the audience at this point doesn't really know, but like I'm half Geordie. So like I grew up, like I'm obsessed. Well, we'll get onto that in a second. I'm not going to say what I'm obsessed with, because that's one of your questions, I think, coming up. But I, you know, I grew up going up there all the time. My dad's like from there, you know, so much of my child, like a lot of childhood memories, but I've never played a gig up there, you know, like ever. I've never, like in any form, not even as a classical performer, like as at least not in Newcastle. So for me, it is like it's like a sort of like a bit of a dream, you know what I mean? It's been a bit of a dream to play in Newcastle to people who, like, you know who we are, you know, since I was started this thing when I was young. But it's only recent, it's now, you know, that it's happening, and like, yeah, and it's actually selling really well. That show is going to be one of the first ones to sell out on the tour as it looks right now. Admittedly, it's not a very big venue, but that doesn't matter.
It's a big enough venue. It's not about the site, in my opinion. With this, with gig venues, sometimes the smaller the venue, the better the sound, the better the more intimate payment. I mean, this is going to be, I mean, the Head of Steam can get really rammed. Like I've seen a few shows where you're like, you're just sandwiched in with your kind of red stripe, do you know what I mean? and it's going to be good because the sound will be good. And I know it's gonna. I've got a good feeling it's going to be a good show. It's not like I'm like, oh well, the venue could be better, but it's not. It's spot on. And
that's good because, you know, that's kind of out of my control to some extent. It's like, you know, whether the venue is the right venue or not. Like, we try our best, but there's got a lot of shows to book, and so I'm really glad when people say, oh, that's a wicked venue, it's going to be great. And so I told you, I think one of my guitarists I work with quite a bit. He's not actually going to be on this tour, sadly, but he's a Geordie, and he grew up playing Head of Steam, and we were talking about, he was like, you know, oh mate, like, it's, you know, he's like, you can, it's one of those that you can like touch the ceiling, you know, stage, but it's like that. But I grew up playing in venues like that, you know, like when I was a teenager, like that was, so it's kind of fun to be doing those venues now, you know.
Good. No, it's going to be really, really good. And you've got some really big gigs coming up as well. Like, you've got Berlin and Hamburg, which are solo shows, so you're doing them on your own, right?
Yeah, well, Berlin and Hamburg are my two kind of, like, outside of London, like the two most popular cities that I've got. You know, those are the ones where, you know, and we've been there twice, but you know, both of the last times have been out there in summer last year, and then in February. You know, those are the two shows that really sell, and, like, you know, packed out, sold out shows each time that we've done them. We've sold them out, basically. And I know we're going to go back next year and do something really exciting. So I've wanted for ages to do a different version of the show. Like, I kind of did that at St. Pancras. We did like a kind of orchestral version. But I've wanted for ages to do a version of the show where I just play the songs the way that I wrote them, you know, more or less, like, and just on my own, like, nothing to hide behind. And that's a lot of it. And that kind of plays into a lot of what we've been talking about, you know, like, there's always a lot to kind of hide behind in entertainment, and we all do it, and there's a massive benefit as well to the illusions of like the show and everything, but there comes a point where you want to have that, like, really vulnerable experience with it. And I think I wasn't really strong enough to do that, I don't think, like, emotionally until recently, or in the right place. But right now I feel like I can actually, like, kind of do that version of it effectively at least a couple times, it's kind of a test. But I'm really excited for those, because it's just what's most interesting is, like, they're interspersed with full band gigs on different nights. So I'm doing whatever, 7 shows in 8 nights or something like that, and 2 of them are solo shows in the mixed in. And so that'll be we'll see how that goes. But I know I'm really looking forward to it.
No, it's going to be good. I mean, I need to know what you're obsessed with. Sorry, my little ADHD brain took over, and I need to know what you're obsessed with. You've got to tell me what you're obsessed with for Newcastle.
Because when I was thinking about this, because you mentioned in your email about, like, you know, what I might be, like, really nerdy about, whatever, because most of my answers naturally would be like film and music things. I was like, no, I'm not going to go. That's what we're talking about in general. What I'm obsessed with since I was a kid is Newcastle United. Like, do you know what I mean? That's like I religiously watch every single game. If it's not on TV, I find somewhere to watch it online on some dodgy website, whatever. Like, me and my dad watch every single game together, and we have for years. And that's like my big passion, which I think people are surprised by. I think people are always surprised when, like, arty, like, musician types or whatever, like, love football. But I just, like, I've been into Newcastle United since I was a kid, like, wearing the shirt and watching games on the weekends and stuff, and going up there, like, with family to watch games, like, all the time. That was just a big part of my childhood. So, like, that's kind of the real, I think, in a way, to go up there and play a show, it's almost like my first home match. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's how it feels. Yeah. And I don't think the audience are going to expect that from me, like, who are coming to the gig, because we've maybe just recently discovered it. I think they'll be surprised that, like, the London boy is a massive, like, Toon Army fan at heart. But that's my nerdy obsession. Just don't test me on any details.
I love it. Note to self, do not come in my Sunderland shirt to your show. Right.
I wondered if you were from Sunderland, but I wasn't going to ask.
Can you tell?
Sure. Don't tell my dad. No, okay. He'll actually, I've got some family coming up to the Newcastle show specifically. It's going to be like a really special night, I think, in that sense.
It's going to be good. You'll have to go back up the stadium and get your photo outside. We'll have to see a selfie of you outside the stadium on your Instagram, most definitely.
I think that's a good idea. Yeah.
Excellent. So Newcastle show is going to be banging. I know it is. Like you say, it's going to, I reckon it'll sell out. I grabbed tickets. I was like,
oh, good. Yeah, yeah. Well, once this episode airs, you know, we're going to have to do 4 or 5 nights.
I was going to say, I hope it doesn't sell out before I do put this episode out. I'll have to put it out earlier in September. So yeah. nerdy fashion, Newcastle United. I can't believe you're half Geordie. How this was just, it was meant to be. It was one of those things. I heard it and then I was like, we're all London based. And he'd mentioned the St. Pancras gig, which I'll come back to in a second. And I was like, most of it's going to be London. And then obviously there was the Newcastle date. And when you said it was your half Geordie, I was like, I cannot believe that this is happening. You know, local Newcastle, little podcast, all about, you know, particularly trying to push the Newcastle scene. Because the Newcastle music scene is fantastic. We have so much. But sometimes gigs just don't take off, you know. So the fact that, you know, you're saying it's getting really, really good response is fantastic. That's what I want to hear. You know, I've seen gigs recently that I've gone into and they should have had much more sales. They should have had much more sales. It's like, how and why? And likewise, you said getting them booked in and getting them booked in when you can. Bands that are touring can't get dates that match with their tours, so then they miss us off. So, you know, trying to go for it. But I'm over the
moon. Newcastle will never be missed off of my tour sheet, that's for sure.
Excellent. Excellent. I really love it. So you've said Berlin, Hamburg, you're going to Mexico City. What happened there? That's a bit of a detour.
Do you know what? My mom asked me the same thing. She was like, really? Do you know what? My sort of Mexico journey started like a year or so ago. But I'm working on a film, which is my favorite author's new book. In fact, actually, this is the book.
Oh wow!
This is her older book.
amazing!
But I've just been obsessed with her for ages. It's about her first book. Widow Basquiat. It's about Jean-Michel Basquiat, you know, the artist, New York artist, and his lover, muse, confidant, and their like kind of bombastic, volatile, beautiful relationship in the 80s. And it's sort of this, yeah, effectively this sort of book about an important theme, a woman who is super important to one of the most prominent artists of our time, and sort of the ways that she, you know, fed into the art and all sorts. And I loved it and was obsessed with it. And I tried to get it years back when I had no, you know, I'd just done one film myself. I didn't really have like, you know, much of a leg to stand on to get a big author's book, but I just loved it and wrote her a letter and ended up not getting, I didn't get it. Turns out like a very, very large Hollywood producer has it now and it's being made now, but that's a whole separate story. So I lost out to good people. But I just like sort of stayed like kind of hustling her for years. And anyway, sort of long story short, I hustled her last year about the project, said I'm still interested if no one's doing it, whatever. And she said it that they are, but that she'd written this new book that was coming out and whether I wanted to read it. And she sent me an early PDF and I just fell in love with it. And so over the last year, she and I have developed this kind of really beautiful, important relationship in my life, like this friendship around this new book of hers, which is her own memoir, not just the story of her friend who was the first book. But this is her story. But in that world of like Frida Kahlo and she basically grew up next door to Frida Kahlo's studio and then became this important part of the 80s New York art scene. So it's sort of a tale of two cities, but it meant that Mexico City was suddenly this really important place in my life that I'd never been to. And so I went out there at New Year's, spent New Year's and like 10 days with this author. We'd never met in person before, but we just had this great trip and I've seen her quite a bit since. And I'm actually going to Mexico on Friday, just kind of like for a bit of a break before all the touring madness. But as soon as I went there, I learned so much about the music scene and all the bands. And like Mexico City has this incredible music scene, which I'd vaguely always heard of because, you know, you see the crowds and the show. But when I went there and I heard what was playing on the radio all the time, which was like Bowie and Queen and The Cure, and you know, Depeche Mode, I was like, man, I fit into this like vibe. Like I am like part of, I hope to be part of that lineage of great artists and music making. And like, I think what I do, the things that appeal to them about this, I think are elements of what I do. And so I just thought, you know what, I'll do one show this year that's just a wild card that I just, you know, I'll do a place I wanna do and see and test a market we haven't tested. And if it loses money, or it doesn't, you know, whatever, then like I'll just plan for that for this one show, you know. And so we put it on sale, like we sort it out, and we're doing Saturday night, Mexico City, me and my drummer coming out. We're doing the full version of the show, but just the two of us. And we'll see. But it's, you know, it's like selling great, and I've got loads of friends and people out there now. And so it's kind of like a really special, and it's the last night of the whole year of touring for me. So I think it's going to be a pretty amazing special night. So that's where that's a very long way of saying where that show came from.
No, it's amazing. It's absolutely fascinating. And this is what I mean about your project. And this is what I see happening. It has so much art and so much influence. And so it's passion. It's got so much passion. Will you have your pink Stratocaster with you?
Well, I think I probably will. It's funny because like that is one of the big questions in my mind right now logistically is like how do I play this Mexico show? Like, you know, it's like great to book a Mexico show, but what does that mean? And so actually I've been having to think hard about like what can I take. If I can't though, I mean, I'll make sure, you know, I'll get something similar out there or something. But don't you worry. I mean, the pink Stratocaster will be on show for quite a bit of the upcoming tour. So
unreal. I saw it when you first bought it on Instagram and I was like, it's a pink Paisley Stratocaster.
I know. Well, you know what? So here's the thing, like, because we're doing this version of the show for the upcoming tour, that's like this kind of like new version of it. It means that I play a bit more guitar and basically the person who was playing quite a lot of guitar isn't playing. So it means I'm doing more of it, but it also means there's not like a bunch of guitars just around at any one point on tour, because they would usually bring a couple as well. So yeah. Now it's just what I've got. And I have my yellow Telecaster, which is like, it's like my kind of workhorse guitar. But that was kind of the only other guitar I have is like a collectible kind of like 70s Gibson, you know, like that's really beautiful. And I've used it in some of my videos. It's like in the one in the ball pit, but like, I can't take it on tour because it's 55 years old and it's fragile and it's already been smashed once before I bought it, which is what made it even affordable for me. And so like, it's just, and it goes out of tune quite quickly, like old guitars do. So I just can't really take it. So I knew I needed to get a backup guitar for touring or even just an alternate tourable guitar. And so I went down to Denmark Street, you know, which is like the main music street in London, knowing I could like spend a sort of modest-ish amount for a guitar, and went around some shops and like, I knew I wanted something that would like, you know, had a real look and was just a bit different and would be great in the show. And like, and then I just kind of saw it and I was like, it's going to be hard for anything to compete with this. You know what I mean? Like, this is so cool. I've never owned a Strat. I've always played Tellies. And I was like, I've always kind of wanted to have a Strat and never had. And so I just was like, you know what, this will be my like 30th birthday present to myself. So I ended up buying the Strat, but I'm really, really glad I did. Like, and it's a 90s Japanese Strat. So yeah, they're actually, you know, it has value beyond, like it will probably hold its value at the very least. And so it's sort of, you know, all the ways we justify these expenses are purchased.
Yeah, but you don't need to tell me. I was looking at a fretless bass the other day and I was like, no, because it's very expensive, but it's beautiful. And it was American jazz bass. And I was like, it'll hold its value, but no, you're not having it.
See, you must have that like extra little bit in your brain that makes sense that says no. Whereas for me, I was like, you know, it'll hold its value. So really, I can't justify not buying it.
You know? Your logo's pink and you have a pink Paisley Stratocaster. You could not have that guitar.
I know, right? That's what I was saying.
And it's a Paisley. I mean, some of the Paisley guitars are worth a fortune just on their own of what they are. So yeah, I mean, it's fab. So cool.
I think I got it on a bit of a steal as well. So I'm happy. I'm happy all around, you know.
I've never been to Denmark Street. I dare not go.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've got, it sounds like you could go, but maybe I won't go with you. I think that might be the kiss of death.
Be like, come here, have a look at this. And I'll just be like, oh, I bought a fretless bass. Oh,
yeah,
man.
No, I'm definitely very persuasive. I don't think you'd want to go shopping with me.
just buy it.
I'm emotionally manipulative. It just wouldn't be good.
So it would be your fault and not mine. That sounds good. So obviously the whole show, the whole tour is coming up. You've got some really cool gigs because you did a really sort of, was it an orchestral piece you did in St. Pancras?
Yeah, well, we did a version of the show with a drummer, but doing more electronic pads and stuff. And then like a string quintet, so five string players, a piano player and a sort of synth guitar guy, and then me. So it was weirdly like the challenge or like the opportunity was like a stripped back version of the show, but in traditional Nowx style, I somehow took that and doubled the size of my band, you know, or tripled the size of my touring band. So yeah, that's kind of my affliction, I guess, is like, oh, you want me to do a smaller thing, so I guess I should add a lot of things I don't normally have, you know. Which again was part of the impulse to do these Night with Nowx, like so fully solo shows. But the St. Pancras thing was magic. I mean, like, that venue is so iconic. I mean, if you look it up online, it's just like suddenly just like a picture of like the Beatles standing in the doorway. Do you know what I mean? It's like hallowed ground. I actually think I saw a ghost in the sound check, which is also like a really weird. Yeah, I haven't really told anyone that, but we were doing the sound check at St. Pancras, and there was this suddenly, and it was closed off to the public, right? Obviously. And suddenly there was this guy like sat in the fourth row wearing like a suit, and he looked like from a different time slightly. Like he just was like kind of had a beard and was just like wearing this like gray suit. And he was like, you know, he was like, shout loud tonight because they're gonna hear you, right? That was his first line. I was like,
oh,
who?
My word.
And he was like, do you know the history? He was like this is the meeting place of the metaphysical poets. You know what I mean? Like Shelley and it's true. Like it was where Shelley and all these like important poets from that time would like gather to like do weird spiritual things. And like sort of like weird pagan energies and stuff. But he was like, you know, tonight, like during the show, like you'll hear the lions roar or whatever. That, he also said that. And like, and I was sort of vaguely ignoring him because, you know, you get used to ignoring. So like, and then like, but then like a second later, like I looked around and he just wasn't there anymore. And no one else had noticed him.
Word.
Yeah, like, which was the really weird part. And like, that was that. And like, it was okay, well, whatever. And he was like, you know, I'll see. He was like, I'm looking forward to the concert tonight before he left. I remember that. And like, he was not at the concert. Do you know what I mean? Like, I never saw him again. So I don't know, call that what you want, but that's like,
I love it.
Ghost on tour.
I love it. You should have gone, oh, you haven't bought a ticket, mate.
Yeah, exactly. It's because you're, you know, from the 1800s doesn't mean you get like a senior discount.
Yeah. I love that. That's amazing. I've seen some weird stuff. Like, yeah. People always, they'll be able to laugh at me because we've got Chillingham Castle up here. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, and it's really supposed to be like super haunted, and that's just weird.
Yeah.
Weird. Like, it's the weirdest castle you'll ever see. So, yeah, I'm all for that kind of thing. It probably was. I mean, the fact that you said this is the meeting place and all that, oh, what a story.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, it was so cool. I mean, obviously, I say don't change. If you're going to make things bigger, I mean, that was one of the things I really like about the tracks because obviously for me, I like my music really involved. So hearing it ramp up and just don't change that. That's just, it just works. It's just,
yeah,
just perfect.
Yeah. Everything I'd like to try one the other way around. I'd love to try one that starts massive and gets really, really small and then gets really big again or whatever. Or just gets smaller. Do you know what? I think that would be a really cool idea for a song that starts huge and just steadily gets smaller. No one really does that, but I think there's no justifiable reason not to do it.
Do it. You've got to try it. Now you've said it, you've got to try it.
Yeah.
You've got to try it now, Nick. You've sold yourself out on that one.
Exactly.
Honestly, it's just so cool. I mean, I had to have you on. This is like everything I heard, I really, really liked, which is unusual for me. Obviously, being from like the goth, the kind of the heavy metal genre, you know, some of the stuff my husband listens to, I find really a bit like, that's in here. But you really, really caught my ear. And that's you know, I love it. I love everything. And I'm so looking forward to the show. I think it'll be really to hear you live because obviously the musicality is there. I know it's going to be good. I know I'm not just going to get like an Instagram version of something and then what turns up isn't the same. I know for a fact in my bones it's going to be this amazing thing. So when this goes out, people, if there are still tickets left, I've only had one, Jane. If there's still tickets left, please buy one. Please go and see it. You know, don't get taken down by the sort of, you know, the idea. The music is fantastic. Listen to the videos, listen to the songs, listen to what Nick does, what he writes, how he sings, how you sing. Oh my word. I mean, like I said, I could tell you were classically trained. You're unbelievable. Like this. This is good. This is gonna go big and you'll be touring all over the place soon. You'd not just be doing Mexico City, you'd be doing all sorts. Before I finish, obviously. What I generally do is ask if there's anything you want to ask me. Now, this can be anything. This can be a challenge. This can be something you want to ask me about Newcastle or anything like that. I think we've already had a bit of a discussion about this, haven't we, Nick?
Yeah. Do you know what? I feel almost like a school kid with what I've suggested. I should have asked you something really deep and meaningful about where you're from.
I mean, I'm from Sunderland. I was born in Sunderland. That's all we need to know about that. Thanks.
Okay.
I support Sunderland.
Oh, yeah.
Go on, because this has had me chuckling for 3 and a bit days now. It's good. It's so good.
Yeah, I can't say anything bad about Sunderland because like I don't know where people are coming to my show from. You know what I mean? Nah, I'm joking. I mean, you know, you got to love the rivalries, right? Like, it'd be so boring if there wasn't Newcastle Sunderland rivalry. What would we all be like fussing about?
Exactly. It is good fun. I mean, Dave from Spartan Warrior, he's a Sunderland supporter, and he's exactly the same. He loves the rivalry. It's galling good fun. Let's not be thinking about it. But I do love talking about the rivalry. It is a good thing. It is.
Well, we'll have some Newcastle Brown Ale up at the show, and we'll have a proper chin wag about the Newcastle Sunderland rivalry.
yes, I love it. So down for that. Come on then. Let's.
All right. So what are the limitations of this? So basically, what I suggested was, it was like a thing when I was at school that you had, I think it's like in 1 minute, like how, like, and I think in theory that we might be just monstrous, like animals with this, but like in theory, I think it's supposed to be hard to eat more than a few of these in like a minute because they're so dry. But I assume we've got the right biscuits. We're going to give it a go. So have you got the same ones?
Yeah, I've got Sainsbury's.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, so
yeah.
I think what we're gonna do. Should we go one at a time and then we can count? Is that the easiest way?
I suspect, because otherwise we're just gonna end up.
You talked about being nervous about like doing interviews, or whatever. Like, I'm actually more nervous about this than I've been about doing the interview.
I'm gonna be eating biscuits on stream. Like, this is going on the internet. We're eating biscuits. Worst things, right? I mean, what are we going to do? Let's set the rules. So we're going to say a minute, are we?
Yeah, why don't you go first? And then I'll do the minute counter.
You're going to wop the floor with us. I'll tell you this.
I don't know. I've got a feeling you might have a secret talent for this. So let's see. All right, so minute starts now. Okay, we've got, half of one biscuit. You've used a quarter of your time. You don't even, go on. You put some effort in. She said the rules of this game were it had to be financially and medically viable, but I think maybe one of those we haven't achieved. Are you struggling? You've got 22 seconds left. So really, I just have to maybe finish one biscuit in order to win this challenge. Oh my God. Okay, you got 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, one biscuit. God, I'm actually nervous now because actually it seems a lot harder than I even thought it was going to be. You can get a drink.
You've got no idea.
You can get a drink now. I think that's you've satisfied the rules. God, maybe I need to have one close by.
I thought I would want that. I was confident all day. That was the hardest thing I think I've ever tried to eat.
Really? I was thinking, because I've never done this either, but I was thinking, you know, we'd each get through like 10 or something. You know what I mean? And then you'd really struggle. But clearly it's harder than you. Yeah. All right.
Don't do what I did. Helpful tip, right?
Yeah.
Don't try and stick too much in at once. You might get further than I did because it just all went, nah, not going anywhere. I'm still eating it. So sorry.
I know, I can see you're still chewing. All right. Should I give this a go?
Yes, let me get my timer, darling.
All right.
This is so funny. I am devastated in myself.
Do you know what? I reckon what at the show, we'll get you up on stage and we'll try round two and you can practice in the meantime.
I purposely didn't eat any either. Just so that I kind of didn't like get an unfair advantage on you.
Yeah.
Right. Here we go. Tell me when you are ready. 3, 2, 1, go. Oh, you see, you've nailed it now. Little and often.
Oh, God. It like expands in your mouth. Oh my God.
You see what I mean?
It just doesn't go away.
I'm still eating mine. You got one and you've got 30 seconds. Oh, you've whomped it. Look at this.
Oh my God. I try singing one of my songs now.
Yeah. Don't choke though.
Oh God. How long have I got?
11 seconds. Oh. 10. Yes!
Oh my God. I'm not even close to... You know what? That was way harder than I thought it was going to be. I haven't even finished.
Well, I just get a drink. Get a drink.
I think I'm good. I think I'm good.
Oh.
Wow. Yeah, I specifically remember. I remember saying in my email when we were talking about this, specifically no chocolate. But I think that's probably for the best. And even throw chocolate into that mix, you wouldn't have even gotten through one.
I know. I was like, so next time, chocolate ones. Secondary, don't shove it all in your mouth at once like I try, because that's just greedy. And also, it doesn't go anywhere. It just kind of just stays. And you got two, so you won it.
I reckon, though, we should call it a draw, because I got to learn from your mistake.
No, you won, fair and square.
All right,
rematch.
Well,
rematch
at the head of steam, mm-hmm. on stage. You and me. I'll see you there.
We're so daft. Honestly, this has been amazing. Thank you so much, Nick. Looking forward to seeing you perform. Really, very much so. And you know, be in touch. I'll let you know when I'm putting this out. But I do a little ending. I always say goodbye. So if you want to say goodbye to everybody, say it now.
Yeah, well, I will. I just want to say, like, also just thanks for having me. And genuinely, like, people like you, and there aren't many like you, are genuinely like that what makes this happen for small artists like me. Do you know what I mean? And like, I just don't take that for granted at all. Like, I genuinely really appreciate you reaching out. It doesn't happen as often as people think, you know what I mean? Like, to have those really good opportunities to talk in so much detail, and like, you've done so much amazing research, and like, I'm honestly like so impressed. So just, yeah, keep going. Please don't stop. And yeah, because we need you, honestly. So thank you for having me.
No, thank you so much for coming on and being such a, it was just so fun. I have loved everything you've said. And I'm looking forward to seeing you. And thank you for the lovely comments. It means a lot, you know, because sometimes I think, oh, am I just being daft? Just get yourself on the internet, love what you're doing. I mean, we've just ate biscuits. But no, thank you for the inspiration. And I will see you on the 4th of October. I'm going to double check that. Yes, 4th of October, Head of Steam. I'll bring some biscuits. Right. Yeah. Over and out from Gigs Up North. Behave. Be good. If you can't be good, don't get caught. All right. Over and out. See you later. Bye.